The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab.
Jeanette Sorrell is an award-winning harpsichordist and conductor and founder of the period instrument group Apollo's Fire, the Cleveland Baroque Orchestra. Welcome. Thanks so much for making time to speak with me.
Oh, thanks, Suzanne.
So, you know, I want to back up to the very beginning because I'm pretty sure that, you know, in your elementary school, they didn't come around and say, and which of you children would like to play harpsichord? So I'd like to know sort of what were your roots in music? How did you get involved personally in making music?
Well, that's actually a pretty funny story. As I was going through kindergarten and first and second grade, I was dying to play the piano. And all I wanted to do was play the piano. And I wanted to have piano lessons. And we didn't have a piano in my house. And my parents were both doing their PhDs at that time. And so there wasn't a lot of money. And I kept begging, can we please have a piano? And it didn't happen. And they didn't realize that it was something that would be important for me. And so finally, when I was in third grade, there was a free program in the public schools at that time where they were offering after-school piano lessons. And the only requirement was just that you had to have a piano at home. You didn't have to pay for the lessons. But and so I lied. And I said that we had a piano. And I made myself a little paper keyboard. And I practiced on it every week. And then once a week before going to the lesson, I would stop in at my friend's house who had a piano, and I would actually play the pieces on her piano. And sometimes we would pretend that I would play her piano when we pretend that she was practicing because she didn't like to practice. And so, but her parents wanted her to practice. So I went on that way for a year. And after a year of this, my parents saw that I was truly obsessed with it. So then they got me a used upright for $125. And I still remember the day that it came. And I just sat at that probably terrible piano for 4 hours playing the handful of little tunes that I knew over and over again. I was thrilled out of my mind.
Wow. That's real dry for such a young girl. And wow.
I was obsessive. Yeah.
So... And very inventive, I might say.
That too, yeah.
So it sounds like you did not come from a musical family if they didn't sort of intuitively realize that having a musical instrument in the house would be something helpful.
Yeah. You know, I came from an academic family. I'm the only member of the family who's not a professor. And my parents love music, and they took me to lots of concerts growing up, which I'm very grateful for. I was just going to concerts all the time because they're very cultured. But the idea that I would actually do that as my profession was something that had not occurred to them.
So how did you find your way to playing the harpsichord then, from, you know, from this obsession with the piano to the harpsichord?
Well, I had certainly always loved playing Bach and Mozart as I was going through high school, and but I ended up in, as an undergrad, switching my major to conducting. And at the point when I became a conducting major, it was required to take a secondary instrument. And so I was looking through the list of instruments that you could study and saw, you know, all the usual ones, which seemed like they'd be incredibly hopeless. And then there was harpsichord there, and I thought, oh, well, that'll be easy. And so I just signed up for harpsichord to fulfill a requirement. And within about 2 or 3 weeks, it was clear to me that this instrument was so much better suited for my hands and my technique, and that I could, you know, really get somewhere with it very easily. And I loved the repertoire, and I loved the earlier end of, you know, the pre-Bach repertoire, which one never plays on the piano.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So it sounds to me like there are sort of two real pivotal moments for you personally in music. I mean, that moment when you got that piano,
yeah,
and then that moment when sort of the light bulb went on.
Yeah.
That's a very common thing I hear from a lot of people who play period instruments. You know, I've known flutists and gamba players and whatever who switched from the modern version of their instrument to an earlier version or a similar early instrument, and they do feel like it's sort of made for them.
Yeah,
Is that the experience
I think,
you had?
Yeah, I think for everybody who goes through that, as you said, you know, it. We do this because it feels right, because it speaks to us. And, you know, I think all of us know going into it that it's not necessarily the decision that will lead to the more lucrative career. That's not the reason to go into early music. But it's a it lends itself to a more personal approach to the music. And to me, it's also something about feeling closer to nature and, you know, working with a very simple instrument. It doesn't have any metal in it. It's very much responding to the changes in the weather all the time, for better or worse. But it just feels like a more natural way to connect with the music.
Mm-hmm. So you say it's not necessarily the most lucrative, but you've done pretty well for yourself. I mean, you have studied with some very, very significant teachers and mentors, Gustav Leonhardt, Roger Norrington, Leonard Bernstein, and that's a pretty all-star list.
Well, I was incredibly fortunate to work with those people at Aspen and Tanglewood and in Amsterdam for a year with Leonhardt, who really, I feel, is the person who developed my Baroque personality more than anyone else. And he's an amazing musician, an amazing player. And I know that many people who study with him feel that he doesn't really teach necessarily. What he tends to do is you play for him and then you step aside and then he plays for you. And that's pretty much it. And for me, that was fantastic. That's what I needed.
So it's not giving you so much verbal feedback or coaching, but actually by leading by example?
The verbal feedback and coaching is very, very succinct. Leonhardt is a man of few words, and every word is perfectly chosen. And I remember that after every lesson, I would go outside and sit down on his doorstep on the Herengracht, the canal in Amsterdam, and I would just write down everything that he said because it was so perfect and I wanted to remember it. But there wasn't that much, you know.
Do you think, were there any disadvantages to studying with someone like Leonhardt or with people who had such sort of legendary status?
Well, you know, with Leonhardt, it was fantastic because I was seeing him every week or every 10 days for a whole year. And I feel like we really understood each other. I have to say, you know, with someone like Leonard Bernstein, I was at Tanglewood, and it was a situation where he was coming in and teaching our conducting class for a few weeks. And that was a little bit more like, you know, a publicity event. He was followed everywhere he went by a sort of paparazzi of photographers. Mm-hmm. And so I have photos of my lesson with him, which I never requested. And in that kind of environment where, you know, every lesson is kind of in front of an audience, there is, I think, a limit to how deep you can really go. Mm-hmm. So I learned the most from Bernstein by watching his rehearsals, I think. That was fantastic. And the other thing was amazing about him was that we had a very international class at Tanglewood. Students were from all over the world. And with very few exceptions, he gave each person's lesson in their native language.
Oh.
Fluently. I'm not just talking French, German, and Italian, but also Russian. And with the Israeli student, he spoke in Hebrew or some branch of that. And it only when we got to the Chinese student did he greeted the student in Chinese, said a few things, and then he said, "I'm sorry, I'm still working on my Chinese, but I'll have to do the rest in English."
Oh my.
So, you know, that gives you a sense of the level of his genius, really.
Yeah. So, you know, not a lot of people go out and form their own orchestra. But you did. You founded Apollo's Fire 92, right?
Yeah.
How'd that come about?
Oh, by accident. Well, I had just come back from this year of studying in Amsterdam with Leonhardt, and I had completely run out of money. I was 26. And, you know, you don't just, like, look in the newspaper and look at the job openings for harpsichord, because there aren't any. And so, having no money, I went back to Oberlin, which was where I had last lived, and I was just staying with friends temporarily until I could figure out some way of being able to pay rent somewhere. And within 2 weeks, I received a phone call out of the blue from the artistic administrator of the Cleveland Orchestra, because they were looking for an assistant conductor, and they had gotten my name from a kind of talent scout who had seen me conducting at Aspen and Tanglewood. And so I was somehow on this list of the 15 up-and-coming young conductors. I think I was number 15 on the list, but that's okay. And so he asked if I would like to interview for this position, which I, of course, had not applied for at all. And I really had no interest in symphonic conducting, but I thought, this is, you know, here I am. I have no money, no job, no prospects. I might as well do this interview. And so I spent 2 days trying to cram Brahms and Beethoven symphonies into my head because I hadn't looked at them in a year. And at the interview, it was with Maestro von Dohnányi. He sort of chatted for about 20 minutes about politics and things like that, and didn't ask me anything about music. And then he finally said to me, "Well, my dear, I don't think there's any point in finding a time for you to audition with the orchestra, because the audience in Cleveland will never accept a woman as a conductor."
Ooh.
And for better or worse, I said, "Well, that's fine, sir, because I didn't apply for this job, and I actually want to work with period instruments," which is not something you say to the Cleveland Orchestra if you want the job. So that was the end of the interview, but the artistic administrator who had set up this interview took me aside, and he was very apologetic and felt terribly, and he said, "You know, I'm so sorry, but I want you to know that I've always wanted to see a Baroque orchestra happen in Cleveland, and I think you're the person to do it. And if you like, I will help you." And so that is how Apollo's Fire got started. He took me down to the Cleveland Foundation, and we had to go 3 times, but in the end, we wore down their resistance, and they gave us a startup grant. And it was amazingly generous on his part, because I really did not know him, and I was 26, and he was very busy, and it wouldn't have happened without his help.
Is he still involved?
Yeah. He is now head of classical music at the BBC. And we will be making our European debut in 2010, including a concert at Wigmore Hall in London.
Wow.
And the BBC is going to broadcast the concert.
Wow.
So it's a nice reconnection with him.
And what will you be playing with that?
It's a program called Fire and Folly, Myths of Love and Betrayal. And so it's pieces that were inspired by various Greek and classical myths, including the myth of Dido, and pieces like Armida Abandonata by Handel. It's with the British soprano Sophie Daneman, who's a lovely, lovely singer. And we'll also feature the orchestra playing some Vivaldi concertos.
Wonderful. So tell me, who are the members of Apollo's Fire? Tell me a little bit about some of the players in the orchestra.
Well, you know, the founding players and I, most of the principal players, have been together now for going on 18 years. Cynthia Roberts, our founding concertmaster, is a wonderful violinist who, like me, studied in the Netherlands, as did our principal cellist, René Schieffer, who actually is Dutch, and he is really a protege of Arno Bylsma and studied with him for 6 years, which you can imagine, if you study with a personality that large for 6 years, it has a big effect on you. But René is definitely his own player at this point. So there is kind of this Dutch stylistic root in our group, but I think that all of us came back to the States and were pretty consciously wanting to take the things we believed in about the Dutch training, but also try to immerse ourselves a little bit further in the concept of communication with Baroque music, because all of what all the treatises talked about in the 17th and 18th centuries was the idea of the goal of music being that you move your listeners emotionally and you're evoking certain moods or affects in the listener. And so really every piece, every phrase should have a distinct character or mood that you're conveying to the listener. And this is something that we have really tried to cultivate in our playing, and we're pretty conscious of, you know, what are we conveying to the audience emotionally at every moment.
Mm. Are the people who play in the group, are they really primarily or exclusively early instrument players, period instrument players, or do they also have sort of the background and the, you know, fluency in both modern instruments as well?
Well, I think that all of them went to a pretty high level with their modern instrument at some point in the past. But most of them do not really play modern very much anymore. Mm. My players are all full-time early music players who travel around to different Baroque orchestras besides Apollo's Fire. And so one week they're playing with me in Cleveland. The next week they might be playing with Philharmonia Baroque in San Francisco. And they're on planes a lot of the time.
Which must be hard when you have a big instrument like a gamba or
yeah.
You know, something that really requires an extra seat and now a lot of extra security, too.
Yes. I feel terrible for those players because it's a lot of hassle. And I must say it's also quite an expense for the groups like us who mm-hmm. are taking care of the travel expenses. But mm-hmm.
Do you travel with your own harpsichord? I would think you would, no?
As much as possible, mm-hmm. yeah. When we tour, you know, as far as the Rocky Mountains, our production manager drives with mm-hmm. a cargo van. The rest of us fly, but he drives with a cargo van with the harpsichord and the cellos and the double bass. But, you know, if we go really all the way to California, then I have to use whatever there is there, and that's always problematic.
That's a diplomatic way of putting it. So how do you go about, you know, you talk about communication, you talk about these players too who are really all over the place, but how do you go about choosing music? You know, what is that process like to choose music for a program, to actually get ready for either a concert season or a recording project? How, like, what's that process like? Can you break it down a little?
Oh, my. well, you know, I guess I have this kind of running list of pieces that I want to do and repertoire ideas. The programming that I do is usually thematic, and I try to, you know, bring pieces together that I think have some kind of either dramatic or contextual relationship. And there's also, in terms of the balance of the season, I'm always trying to have a combination of things that might be familiar masterpieces that we are presenting, hopefully in a fresh way, and making people see them in a new way, in addition to less well-known pieces, neglected masterpieces from the past that are going to be new to the audience. So there's always a mix of that. And I do quite a lot with marking various nuances into the parts ahead of time, just because when my players are here in Cleveland, we're all assembled for a relatively short amount of time, and we work really quickly. And we're all sort of steeped in the same style, and so it works really easily. But I find that when, you know, if I'm clear about my musical ideas and they're marked into the parts to some extent, it just gets us to the next step already at the first rehearsal, and we can just go farther.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also lead modern orchestras,
yes.
Correct?
Uh-huh.
So how is that different? How is it different to go into leading a modern orchestra in really completely different repertory?
Yeah. Well, I must say that I, these days, really don't do anything later than Beethoven and Schubert if I'm working with a symphony orchestra, because I just feel that I might as well do what I'm best at. And there are so many other conductors who can do wonderful Brahms and Shostakovich. They don't need me for that. So, but, you know, with when I do Mozart with the symphony orchestra, we have a great time. And it's mostly about liberating them to play with more energy and more expression. Because I think that when you're playing Mozart on modern instruments, there's a natural tendency to kind of feel like you're walking on eggshells, because the instruments are actually too heavy for the repertoire. But what I try to get the string players to do is to play with much faster bow, but much less pressure. And so you can play with a lot more energy because you're using more bow, but it's not digging into the string and you're not getting that harsh sound that you can get from modern strings. And so that's a big change for people. And I, you know, usually spend the first two rehearsals just over and over encouraging them. You can go even farther. Yep, even more. But people seem to have fun with it. And it's, I think it's a, you know, refreshing change from the way in which they're used to playing sometimes. So.
Sure. And I know a number of orchestral players, and it's probably an overstatement to say it this way, but it's the only way I can think of. But I think they do kind of get in a little bit of a rut. You know, they do sort it does start to feel a little repetitive. So I would think that that would be a nice way to infuse some fresh energy and perspective and make it a little bit more of a challenge in a good way.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's my role as a guest conductor with a symphony orchestra, is just to say, you know, here's a different way of looking at this music for this week. You know, let's try it this way this week. Mm-hmm. And what they do the rest of the time is between them and their music director.
So the revival of Baroque and early music, it's been going on for, you know, more half a century or so, a little bit more than that now. Now, you've, of course, only come in on the recent tail end of that, but I'm sort of curious to know, how do you think it's evolved? Where do you think it's heading? You know, because this is kind of an exciting time. It's really sort of a much more established, accepted, mainstream kind of genre. And, you know, what's the future looking like for early music and Baroque music?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just amazing to me how every decade the level of professionalism in the field grows exponentially. And, you know, these days, the top players in conservatories are often going into early music by choice. And that didn't used to be the case 20 years ago. But the thing that I am most grateful for is that that early generation of pioneering early music leaders
like
in the 60s, like Leonhardt and like my teacher Lisa Crawford at Oberlin, the people who were working in the 60s and 70s, who really had to work only with sources in libraries and instruments that very few people knew how to play, they had to figure out everything on their own. And the fact that we today in the early music field can do what we're doing would not be possible without what they did. You know, they got us to a certain step, and it's now easy for us to sort of continue on from there. But I think it took incredible determination and genius, really, to walk into libraries and figure out and reconstruct a musical style without having anything to listen to.
Mm-hmm. You have to know where to look to begin with, just to see what is expected of you, and then try to decipher it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I know that a lot of Sunday Baroque listeners will say that they've come to this music, listening to this music, maybe from no background in classical music whatsoever. You know, they were rock and roll fans, or, you know, a lot of young heavy metal listeners. I haven't figured that out yet, but they come to it from a very, very different background and perspective and really find it very appealing and very welcoming. Perhaps some Apollo's Fire audience members tell you the same thing. And I'm curious to know what you think that's about. Why is Baroque and early music something that seems to be such a a good threshold for people who don't have that background in music, in classical music tradition?
Well, I think that what I so often hear from audience members is that they love the intimacy of the experience with Baroque music because at least most Baroque orchestras and Baroque ensembles tend to play in fairly intimate venues. And the people who go into the field, the performers, tend to be expressive performers who are really bringing their personality to the music. And I think that audience members really respond to that and they feel more drawn in. And there's also, you know, Baroque music is quintessentially connected to dance. And there's so much buoyancy in the rhythm, even in pieces that were not meant to be danced to, it's still there, you know. And I think even when you're listening to a recording on the radio and you can't see the performance, people subconsciously respond to that sense of spirit and liveliness and dance.
Mm-hmm. I think that's well said. I think it just resonates with people kind of very physically.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it is a harmonic vocabulary that's relatively simple and very much closely related to the harmonic overtone series. And, you know, it's easier to relate to that and to the simple harmonies of pop music than listening to something like Schoenberg, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so listening to music, this is your, you know, it's your job. So I'm wondering what you do for fun. Do you listen to music for fun? Maybe you like silence for fun. Or do you listen to something besides Baroque and early music for fun?
Well, I am a big lover of folk music, Celtic and old time and all of the gradations in between. So, you know, on weekends and relaxing, I love to listen to whatever folk music is on the radio. And in Apollo's Fire, we have a kind of crossover folk wing. And in the summer times, we play concerts in rustic venues, including a historic barn. And I develop these crossover folk programs each year, which, although it's become, you know, a financially important thing that we do, I really do it because I love the music, and it's just a nice thing to do in the summertime.
Mm-hmm. So. The same people from the core group of the orchestra play in both?
There are a few that are the same. Kathy Stewart plays Baroque flute with us during the regular season and plays folk flutes, Irish flutes, in the folk concerts. Renee Schieffer, a cellist, plays in both groups. And often David Greenberg, who plays violin with us in the season, also plays in the folk programs. But then in the folk programs, we have a fantastic hammer dulcimer player named Tina Bergman, who I really believe is the world-class hammer dulcimer player anywhere. So it's always great fun collaborating with her. And our soprano Sandy Simon sings in those programs and often sings in the Baroque programs as well.
Hmm. You also have that, I was reading in one of your bios about the experience in the Baptist church with the
uh-huh.
shape note singing and all of that. Do you want to tell that story? Or?
Oh, sure.
It's sort of related to this folk
yes. Yes.
wing.
Yeah. Well, the program that I just most recently developed for our crossover series is a program called Come to the River, an early American gathering. And it was inspired by an experience that I had when I was 14. I moved with my family from the city to a small town in rural Virginia, which was a huge culture shock for me. And I spent the first year just trying to learn how to understand the Southern accents. But I was asked to be the pianist for a small country church. It was my first job. I was 15. And it was very eye-opening for me to go to this kind of revivalist church. But I encountered there the really beautiful stark harmonies of shape note singing. Pieces like What Wondrous Love Is This from the Southern Harmony Hymnal. And the music made a huge impression on me. And so from those roots many, many years ago have sprung this new program. And it involves four singer-actors, and there's kind of a theatrical storyline about a preacher taking his family on a covered wagon journey down to the South, where he leads the first ever revival meeting in 1801. And this is based on a historical figure, the preacher. The program premiered in 10 sold-out concerts, to our surprise. And as a result, there's now going to be a significant tour next year. And there's a CD coming out as well. Oh. So what started as something that was just really for fun is becoming a significant project now.
That's great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So I'm curious to know, too, what other projects you might have in the works. It seems like you've really branched out into some very interesting things. And I'm wondering if there's sort of like a holy grail that you have. There's something that you just sort of hold in your heart as the, you know, the goal, the dream gig or the dream project.
Well, I feel incredibly blessed next season that we will be doing kind of my holy grail piece on tour. 2010 is the 400th anniversary of the Monteverdi Vespers, as you know. Mm-hmm. And it is, in my opinion, one of the handful of masterpieces of all time. I really feel that Monteverdi was playing the same kind of role as Beethoven hundreds of years later, in the sense that both of them were giants living at the end of a particular stylistic era and kind of taking the tools of that era and forging a new style, mostly by sheer force of will. And so Beethoven was, you know, creating the romantic style out of the classical style, mostly by his own determination, including breaking piano strings all the time, you know. And Monteverdi was doing the same thing, working with Baroque tools and creating working with Renaissance tools and creating the Baroque. So we are returning to the Vespers next fall, and we'll be touring around the country with it. And it's a great privilege every time to do that piece.
And anything else, any other special projects that you're looking forward to or hoping to look forward to?
In November 2010, we are making our European debut tour, finally. It'll be exciting playing in the Netherlands, where many of us were trained, as well as in London. And the rest of the itinerary is still developing, but maybe including Spain as well. So that'll be a fun adventure and nice to bring our music to some new listeners.
Yeah. Jeanette Searle, thank you so much for making time to speak with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
And best of luck.
Thank you.